"What is that thing?" I exclaimed.
"The U-2," Bohm whispered and put a finger to his lips. "You've just had a look at the most secret project in the free world."
6. Picture postcards for Ike. The full weight of government secrecy fell on me like a sack of cement that first day inside Kelly Johnson's guarded domain. Learning an absolutely momentous national security secret just took my breath away, and I left work bursting with both pride and energy to be on the inside of a project so special and closely held, but also nervous about the burdens it would impose on my life. I hadn't been inside the Skunk Works 2 minutes before realizing that everything that happened there revolved around one man, Clarence L. Kelly Johnson. Kelly's assistant, Dick Bohm, wasn't about to brief me or tell me my duties. That was up to the boss himself, and Dick dutifully escorted me down the hall to Kelly's corner office and stood by while Kelly, in shirt sleeves behind a behemoth-sized mahogany desk, half-hidden by an impressive stack of blueprints, welcomed me with neither a smile nor a handshake, but got to the point immediately. "Rich, this project is so secret that you may have a 6-month to 1-year hole in your resume that can never be filled in. Whatever you learn, see, and hear for as long as you work inside this building stays forever inside this building. Is that clear? You'll tell no one about what we do or what you do. Not your wife, your mother, your brother, your girlfriend, your priest, or your CPA. You got that straight?"
"Yes, sure," I replied.
"Okay. First read over this briefing disclosure form, which says what I've just said only in governmentese. Just remember, having a big mouth will cost you 20 years in Leavenworth minimum. Sign it, and then we'll talk." He then continued, "I'm going to tell you what you need to know so that you can do your job. Nothing more, nothing less. We are building a very special airplane that will fly at least 15,000 feet higher than any Russian fighter or missile. So it will be able to fly across all of Russia, hopefully undetected, and send back beautiful picture postcards to Ike." I gulped. "That's its mission. Edwin Land, who designed the Polaroid camera, is also designing our cameras, the highest resolution camera in the world. He's got Jim Baker, the Harvard astronomer, doing a 36-inch folded optic lens for us. We'll be able to read license plates. And we've got Eastman Kodak developing a special thin film that comes in 3,600-foot rolls, so we won't run out." He handed me a large folder crammed with papers. "I've got a guy working on the engine inlets and exit designs. Here's his work so far. I want you to review it carefully because I don't think he's up to speed. I also want you to take over all the calculations on what we'll need for cabin heating and cooling, hydraulics and fuel control. I don't know how long I'll need you here, maybe 6 weeks, maybe 6 months. I've promised to have this prototype flying in 6 months. That will mean working 6-day weeks, at least." He dismissed me with the back of his hand, and a few minutes later I was squeezed into an empty desk in a room jam-packed with 35 growling, snorting designers and engineers, many of whom I had worked with on the F-104 Starfighter. Dick Fuller, an aerodynamicist who had come over from the main plant only the day before, was seated on one side of me, and a stability and control specialist named Don Nelson was on the other side. Our desks touched. We could put our arms around each other without even stretching. In Kelly's tight little island, there was a yawning chasm between secrecy and privacy. That first night I got home 2 hours later than usual, and Faye was not exactly delighted to see me. She had bathed our 2-year-old son Michael, put him to bed, and had eaten alone. Up until now, I had always been able to share my day with her, and she enjoyed hearing about office gossip and some of the airplanes I worked on, even though I spared her the eye-glazing technical details of my work. I was one engineer who knew how damned boring other engineers could be when we talked shop at parties.
"Well, how did it go?" Faye asked.
I sighed. "From now on, I'll be home closer to midnight than dinner time, and I have to work Saturdays. It's so secret we don't even have secretaries or janitors."
"Oh, my God," Faye exclaimed. "Don't tell me you're involved with a bomb."
5 years later, when Francis Gary Powers was shot down over the Soviet Union and the U-2 spy plane was revealed in headlines around the world, I was finally able to tell my wife that I helped build that airplane. I figured as much, she insisted. I erroneously assumed that we were building this U-2 for the U.S. Air Force. This assumption was based on the fact that the spy plane in question had wings and flew and therefore would be in the province of Blue Suitors. But Ed Baldwin set me straight. Baldy was Kelly's structural designer, as crusty as a pumpernickel, who would remain unmellowed more than 20 years later while working for me on the stealth fighter. Over lunch, I remarked at the absence of a single Air Force project officer on hand to monitor progress, or kibitz, as we built their airplane. "Friend, this project is Central Intelligence Agency all the way," Baldwin remarked. "Everything about it is under the spook's direction."
"You mean the CIA will have its own Air Force?"
"You said it," Baldy grinned. "The rumor is that Kelly will give them all Lockheed test pilots to fly this thing. We're also going to furnish all their mechanics and ground crew and build them a training base somewhere out in the boonies." As it turned out, Baldy's rumors were two-thirds accurate. The agency hired its own pilots from the ranks of the Air Force, but we put them on the books as Lockheed employees so that their payment came out of a special Lockheed account of laundered CIA money rather than straight government checks. The subterfuge was that the pilots were Lockheed employees involved in a government-contracted high-altitude weather and performance study. Everything about this project was dark alley, cloak and dagger. Even the way they financed the operation was highly unconventional. Using secret contingency funds, they backdoored payment to Lockheed by writing personal checks to Kelly for more than $1 million as startup costs. The checks arrived by regular mail at his Encino home, which had to be the wildest government payout in history. Johnson could have absconded with the dough and taken off on a one-way ticket to Tahiti. He banked the funds through a phony company called C&J Engineering, the C&J standing for Clarence Johnson. Even our drawings bore the logo C&J. The word Lockheed never appeared. We used a mail drop out at Sunland, a remote location in the San Fernando Valley, for suppliers to send us parts. The local postmaster got curious about all the crates and boxes piling up in his bins and looked up C&J in the phone book and, of course, found nothing. So he decided to have one of his inspectors follow our unmarked van as it traveled back to Burbank. Our security people nabbed him just outside the plant and had him signing national security secrecy forms until he pleaded writer's cramp. Clearly, building this airplane was deadly serious business. Inside the Skunk Works, our irreverent group privately scoffed at the secret agent mentality of the agency's security guys, who made us take aliases if we had to travel on business in connection with the project. I chose the name Bend Over, as in Bend Over, the name of a British music hall variety star of my father's misspent youth. Still, all of us involved in building this particular airplane felt the weightiness of our mission. Kelly was regularly briefed at the agency on the real state of the world, which he assured us was 70% worse than anything we read in our morning papers. He didn't hide from us his view that the success of U-2 operations might make the difference between our country's survival or not. The Russians were crashing development of an intercontinental ballistic missile with powerful liquid fuel engines, and East-West tensions were strained to the breaking point. Both the United States and Soviet Union had already successfully tested H-bombs within the past year and seemed poised to use them. John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower's Secretary of State, warned that we would go to the brink of war to combat communist expansion, coining the term brinkmanship for his eye-to-eye confrontation technique. He acknowledged the Russians' incredible conventional might. They out-divisioned us by a factor of 10, out-tanked us by a factor of 8, out-airplaned us by a factor of 4. But Dulles drew lines in the sand around the world and served notice that if the communists crossed any one of them, it would mean instant nuclear retaliation on a massive scale. Going to the verge of war without actually getting into war is the necessary art, Dulles claimed. But that Russian bear seemed 15 feet tall.
Around the time we started working three shifts getting the U-2 built in the summer of 1955, a national poll of adult Americans indicated that more than half the population thought it more likely that they would die in a thermonuclear war than of old-age diseases. Around the country, some anxious people began digging fallout shelters in their backyards and stocking them with Geiger counters and oxygen tanks. They were motivated to keep on digging by front-page diagrams in their papers, showing how an H-bomb exploded over Manhattan would trigger a 4-mile fireball vaporizing all in its path from Central Park to Washington Square and creating more than 1 million casualties in less than 2 minutes. Like millions of other couples raising a family, my wife and I were forced to ponder the unthinkable. What would we do if L.A. was nuked? Assuming we survived the blast, where would we go? How would we protect ourselves from radiation and fallout? To even raise such questions was heartbreaking because there were no answers apparent at all. So I had no trouble motivating myself to work hard, long hours to build the U-2. This was the airplane our government was impatiently waiting for to breach the Iron Curtain and finally discover the scope and dimensions of the Soviet threat. There was no way to hide from our cameras, and there was no hostile action the Russians could take that could stop us from our flights. We would be flying beyond reach of their defenses. Eisenhower was being regularly briefed on our progress and sent word to Kelly via John Foster's brother, Alan Dulles, who ran the CIA, to crack the whip and get that U-2 launched. The president was receiving persistent warnings from the Joint Chiefs and the CIA that the Russians might be preparing to launch a preemptive first-strike nuclear attack against the United States. The evidence was fragmentary but unsettling. Khrushchev had bragged, "We will bury you," and at the 1954 May Day parade he gave our military attachés a chilling glimpse at what seemed to be his latest gravemakers, a half-dozen new long-range missiles on huge portable launchers being trucked through Red Square, while overhead wave after wave of a new heavy bomber rattled the Moscow rooftops. Our military observers from the embassy counted 100 bombers, nicknamed the Bison, that were capable of reaching New York with a nuclear payload. Only after the first U-2 flights was this estimate reassessed, and our observers realized they had probably been duped. The Russians appeared to have flown the same 20 or so bombers over the Kremlin in a big circle. But the missiles seemed to confirm spy reports that the Soviets were working on a huge 240,000-pound thrust rocket engine. Why this crash program in long-range weapons? We were countering the Bisons with a new bomber of our own, the long-range B-52. But the trouble was we didn't have enough reliable information on precise locations of Russian bases and key industries to devise strategic targeting plans. We possessed only the most rudimentary idea of where vital Soviet bases and industrial centers were located, or how well they were defended, or the kinds of terrain that a bombing mission would encounter going in and coming out. A massive amount of photo mapping and technical intelligence was needed to provide the Strategic Air Command with an up-to-date, comprehensive targeting plan. Without an airplane like the U-2 that could overfly at heights above harm, the Blue Suiters were driven to use aggressive, dangerous tactics. Had the American public known about the ongoing secret air war between the two superpowers, they would have been even more in despair than many already were about the state of the world. There had been dozens of American attempts during the early 1950s to gather important Russian radar and electronic communications frequencies by flying provocatively up against the Soviet coastline and occasionally overflying their territory by as much as 200 miles. Several of these unarmed reconnaissance aircraft were shot down, either by Soviet jets or ground fire. Most of the crews, totaling more than 100 servicemen, simply disappeared off the scope and were presumed to have been sent to Siberia and or killed. Eisenhower finally ordered fighter escorts for these reconnaissance missions, resulting in several fierce dogfights with Soviet MiGs over the Sea of Japan. Ike was normally very cautious, but he was so intent on gaining information on Soviet missile development that he approved a joint CIA-British Air Force operation in the summer of 1955, in which a stripped-down Canberra bomber flew at 55,000 feet, well above the range of Soviet fighters, and photographed the secret missile test facility called Kapustin Yar, east of Volgograd. The Canberra was hit more than a dozen times by ground fire and barely made it back to base. The crew reported that the Soviets seemed to have been alerted to the mission, and years later the CIA concluded that the operation had indeed been compromised by the notorious Kim Philby, a high-level official in British intelligence who was a mole for the KGB. In a final act of desperation before our spy plane could be launched, the Blue Suiters began sending up spy balloons over Russia loaded with electronic gathering devices. They were announced as a weather systems survey, but the Soviets weren't fooled and immediately fired off angry protests to Washington. They also shot down some of the balloons, while the majority floated off into limbo. Only about 30 made it back to our side, and we actually learned a lot of useful information about Russian weather, especially wind patterns and barometric pressures. This was pathetic, primitive stuff compared to the promise of our U-2. Dr. Edwin Land, who had pushed the idea of a high-flying spy plane in his role as a special technical consultant to the White House, had promised President Eisenhower a tremendous intelligence bonanza. A single mission in clear weather can photograph in revealing detail a strip of Russia 200 miles wide and 2,500 miles long and produce 4,000 sharp pictures, he wrote in his proposal. Land predicted the U-2 would obtain a detailed photographic record of Soviet railroads, power grids, industrial facilities, nuclear plants, shipyards, airbases, missile test sites, and any other target of strategic value. If we are successful, it can be the greatest intelligence coup in history, Land assured the president. We had stretched the design of this airplane to the limit to achieve unprecedented range and altitude. It could fly 9 hours, travel 4,000 miles, and reach heights above 70,000 feet. The wings extended 80 feet, providing unusual lift capacity, like a giant condor gliding on the thermals. Except, of course, that the U-2 did no gliding and flew high above the jet stream. Our long wings stored 1,350 gallons of fuel in 4 separate tanks. Each pound adding to the airplane's overall weight cost us 1 foot of altitude. So, while building the U-2, we were ruthless Weight Watchers. 70,000 feet was our operational goal. Intelligence experts believed, erroneously as it turned out, that altitude put our pilots beyond the range limits of Soviet defensive radar. That height was, however, beyond reach of their fighters and missiles. We designed and built that airplane for lightness. The wings, for example, weighed only 4 pounds per square foot, one-third the weight of conventional jet aircraft wings. For taxiing and takeoffs, jettisonable twin-wheeled pogos were fitted beneath the enormous fuel-loaded wings and kept them from sagging onto the runway while taking off. The pogos dropped away as the U-2 became airborne. The fuselage was 50 feet long, built of wafer-thin aluminum. One day on the assembly floor, I saw a worker accidentally bang his toolbox against the airplane and cause a 4-inch dent. We looked at each other and shared the same unspoken thought. Was this airplane too damned fragile to fly? It was a fear widely shared inside the Skunk Works that quickly transferred onto the flight line. Pilots were scared to death flying those big flapping wings into bad weather situations, afraid the wings would snap off. The U-2 had to be handled carefully, but proved to be a much tougher, more resilient bird than, frankly, I would ever have guessed. The landing gear was the lightest ever designed, weighing only 200 pounds. It was a two-wheel bicycle configuration with a nose wheel and a second wheel in the belly of the airplane. Tandem wheels were used on gliders, but this was the first time ever for a powered airplane, which usually had tricycle landing gears. Ours would cause pilot trepidations about landing the U-2 that never quite evaporated, no matter how many landings a pilot successfully completed. Adding to the sense of the airplane's fragility was that the razor-thin tail would be attached to the fuselage by just 3 5/8-inch bolts. The heart of the U-2 were hatches in the equipment or cue bay that would house 2 high-resolution cameras, one a special long focal length spotting camera able to resolve objects 2 to 3 feet across from a height of 70,000 feet, and the other a tracking camera that would produce a continuous strip of film of the whole flight path. The 2 cameras weighed 750 pounds. Kelly and Dr. Land argued constantly about each other's needs to dominate the relatively small space inside those bays. Kelly needed room for batteries. Land needed all the room he could get for his bulky folding cameras. Kelly's temper flashed at Land. "Let me remind you, unless we can fly this thing, you've got nothing to take pictures of." In the end, they compromised. My principal work was on the engine's air intake, which had to be designed and constructed with absolute precision to maximize delivery of the thin-altitude air into the compressor face. Up where the U-2 aimed to cruise, just south of the pearly gates, the air was so thin that an oxygen molecule was about as precious as a raindrop on the Mojave Desert. So the intakes had to be extremely efficient to suck in the maximum amount of oxygen-starved air for compression and burning. The real crunch was building a reliable engine for flying at the top of the stratosphere and finding special fuel that could operate effectively with so little oxygen. Pratt and Whitney built the highest pressure ratio engine available at that time, their J-57 engine, which Kelly hoped could somehow be adopted for the U-2. He had met with Bill Gwynn, the head of Pratt and Whitney at the company's main plant in Hartford, Connecticut. "Bill," he said, "I need to fly at 70,000 feet. Gwynn scratched his head. "We've never come close to that height, Kelly. I have no idea what's the fuel consumption and thrust needed to get up that high." He put his best people to work on the problem. They were modifying most of the J-57's innards, the alternator, oil cooler, hydraulic pump, and other key parts for extreme altitude flying. The 2-spool compressor and 3-stage turbine were being hand-built. Even with these modifications, the engine would be able to produce only 7% of its takeoff sea-level thrust at 70,000 feet. The U-2 would be flying where outside temperatures would be minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit, causing standard military JP-4 kerosene fuel to freeze or boil off due to low atmospheric pressures. So Kelly turned to retired General Jimmy Doolittle, who was a key Eisenhower advisor on military and intelligence matters, as well as a board member of Shell Oil. Doolittle put the muscle on Shell to develop a special low-vapor kerosene for high altitudes. The fuel was designated LF-1A. The rumor about the LF abbreviation was that it stood for lighter fluid. The stuff smelled like lighter fluid, but a match wouldn't light it. Actually, it was very similar in chemistry to a popular insecticide and bug spray of that era known as Flit. Once our airplane became operational, Shell diverted tens of thousands of gallons of Flit to make LF-1A in the summer of 1955, triggering a nationwide shortage of bug spray. Kelly suffered stress headaches worrying about the engine and fuel performance at such incredible altitudes. Several of our own engineers were dubious that a conventional jet engine could ever be made to function properly in a realm where experimental ramjets had flown for only minutes at blistering supersonic speeds. That kind of tremendous brute power was necessary to gulp down enormous quantities of oxygen-thin air. All of us worried about what would happen if the engine died above Russia, forcing the pilot to glide to lower altitudes to restart, placing him in range of Soviet missiles and fighters. I had never before worked with so much intensity and camaraderie. Very quickly, 45-hour work weeks would seem a luxury. We began logging 60 to 70-hour work weeks to meet the schedule. I had begun by reviewing the work of my predecessor, who I thought had done a competent job, but I quickly learned that Kelly had blind spots about certain people that could never be changed. For instance, I observed that he was particularly harsh in his dealings with a couple of engineers whom I considered to be extraordinarily good. And in my youthful naivete, it never dawned on me that there might have been jealousy at play. Kelly was so hands-on that I quickly lost self-consciousness around him, although that was certainly not true of most others. I actually observed guys flushing and breaking out in a nervous sweat every time they had to deal with him, even several times a morning. Very quickly, I felt part of his team, but far from being a key player. Some days he remembered my name, and other times he clearly fudged it. But for whatever reason, I discovered that I really was not afraid of him. If I screwed up, I quickly admitted it and corrected my mistake. For example, one day I suggested something that would have added a hydraulic damper into the design, and that meant decreasing altitude by increasing weight. I saw Kelly's face cloud over before I even finished speaking, and I immediately slapped my forehead and said, "Wait a minute. I'm a dumb shit. You're trying to take off pounds. Back to the drawing board." The guys who tried to finesse mistakes and hoped that Kelly would not notice usually wished they had never been born. Nothing got by the boss. Nothing. And that was my sharpest impression of him, one that never changed over the years. I had never known anyone so expert at every aspect of airplane design and building. He was a great structures man, a great designer, a great aerodynamicist, a great weights man. He was so sharp and instinctive that he often took my breath away. I'd say to him, "Kelly, the shockwave coming off this spike will hit the tail." He would nod, "Yeah, the temperature there will be 600 degrees. I'd go back to my desk and spend 2 hours with a calculator and come up with a figure of 614 degrees. Truly amazing. Or I'd remark, "Kelly, the structure load here will be," and he would interrupt and say, "about 6.2 PSI. And I'd go back and do some complicated drudge work, and half an hour later reach a figure of 6.3. Kelly just assumed that anyone he selected to work for him would be more than merely competent. I assume he felt that way about me. But during those feverish days of getting that first U-2 prototype built, I was just another worker bee in his swarming hive, and I actually learned to love our slum-like working conditions. Everyone smoked in those days, and the smoke clouds resembled a thick London fog. Since no outsiders, including secretaries or janitors, were allowed near us, we did our own sweeping up and took turns making our own coffee. Working to giddiness, we acted like college sophomores a shocking amount of the time. We hung daring pictures of petty girls in scanty swimsuits, which could be flipped around to reveal on the opposite side a reproduction of waterfowl. On rare occasions when Kelly brought in visitors, someone would shout, "Present ducks!" and we'd flip our three-framed pictures of full-breasted beauties. Once we had a contest to measure our asses with calipers. Leave it to me, I had never won a contest before in my life, and I won that one. I was presented with a certificate proclaiming me Broad Butt of the Year. From then on, Broad Butt was my nickname. It was still better than Dick Fuller's, though. Everyone called him Fuller Dick, and we were supposedly an elite group doing momentous work. The CIA was not at all in evidence unless I knew who I was looking for. Every few weeks I would catch a glimpse of a tall, patrician gentleman dressed improbably in tennis shoes, freshly pressed gray trousers, and a garish big-checked sport jacket that any racetrack bookmaker would have been proud of. I once asked Dick Bohm who that guy was, and he replied with a stern, "What guy? I don't see a soul." Kelly made sure that few of us had any dealings with the visitor who appeared every few weeks or so. Many months went by before I heard someone refer to him as Mr. B. No one besides Kelly knew his name. Mr. B was Richard Bissell, former Yale economics professor and Alan Dulles's special assistant, put in charge of running the CIA's spy plane project, who became the unofficial godfather of the Skunk Works, the government official who really put us on the map. He became one of Kelly's closest confidants and our most ardent champion. Ultimately, he ran all the spy plane and satellite operations for the agency until the last months of the Eisenhower administration in late 1959, when Alan Dulles put him in charge of organizing a group of Cuban emigres into a ragtag battle brigade that would attempt to invade the island at the Bay of Pigs. But in the early days of the U-2, he was a mysterious figure to most of us, part of a complicated working arrangement involving the agency, Lockheed, and the Air Force. It was unprecedented in the annals of the military-industrial complex. The operational plan for deploying our highly secret airplane was approved personally by President Eisenhower. Under this plan, The CIA was responsible for overseeing production of the airplane and its cameras, for choosing the bases, and providing security, and for processing the film. No mean feat, since the special tightly wound film developed by Eastman Kodak would stretch from Washington halfway to Baltimore on each mission. The Air Force would recruit the pilots, provide mission and weather planning, and run the daily base operations. Lockheed would design and build the airplane and provide ground crews for the bases and a cover for the pilots, who would carry Lockheed IDs and be officially logged on the company books as pilots for a government-contracted weather investigation program. The reason why Kelly could move so quickly building the U-2 was that he could use the same tools from the prototype of the XF-104 fighter. The U-2, from nose to cockpit, was basically the front half of the F-104, but with an extended body from cockpit to tail. Using that tooling would save many months and a lot of money. Our goal was to put four birds in flight by the end of the first year. Each airplane would cost the American taxpayers $1 million, including all development costs, making it the greatest procurement bargain ever. By April 1955, the first U-2 was being built under tight wraps inside the assembly area of Building 82, and Kelly sent for his chief engineering test pilot, Tony LeVere, who had flight-tested all of Johnson's airplanes since the days of the P-38. "Close the goddamn door," he said to Tony. "Listen, you want to fly my new airplane?" Tony replied, "What is it?" Kelly shook his head. "I can't tell you. Only if you say yes first. If not, get your ass out of here." Tony said yes. Kelly reached into his desk and unrolled a large blueprint drawing of the U-2. Tony began to laugh. "For Christ's sake, Kelly, first you have me flying your goddamn F-104, which has the shortest wings ever built, and now you got me flying a big goddamn sailplane with the longest wingspan I ever saw. Like a goddamn bridge." Kelly rolled up the drawing. "Tony, this is top secret. What you just saw, you must never mention to another living soul. Not your wife, your mother, nobody. You understand? Now listen, I want you to take the company Bonanza and find us a place out on the desert somewhere where we can test this thing in secret. And don't tell anyone what you're up to." LeVere knew the vast sprawl of desert terrain shared by California and Nevada as well as any mule-packing 49er. As a test pilot, he had mapped in his mind nearly every dry lake bed between Burbank and Las Vegas as a possible emergency landing strip. So he took off on his scouting expedition, after telling fellow pilots he was off to count whales for the Navy, a project Lockheed had actually done from time to time, and headed north toward Death Valley. 2 days later, he found the perfect spot. "I gave it a 10+, he told me years later. "Just dandy. A dry lake bed about 3.5 miles around. I had some 16-pound cast iron shot put balls with me and dropped one out to see if the surface was deep sand. Damned if it wasn't hard as a tabletop. I landed and took pictures." A few days later, Tony flew Kelly and a tall civilian, introduced to him only as Mr. B., to the site to take a look. His wife had packed a picnic lunch, but a stiff wind began howling, blowing large stones across the surface of the dry lake. "This will do nicely," Mr. B. remarked. The area was not only remote but off-limits to all unauthorized air traffic because of its proximity to nuclear testing. As Kelly noted in his private log that day, "Flew out and located runway at south end of lake, then flew back very illegally over the atomic bomb sitting on its tower about 9 hours before it was set to go off. Mr. Bissell pleased. He enjoyed my proposed name for the site as Paradise Ranch." From mid-May to mid-July, the pressure on the workers building the first U-2 grew in intensity to a point where three shifts were working 80 hours weekly. To put an airplane in the sky in only 8 months was a tremendous achievement. On June 20th, 1955, Kelly noted in his log, "A very busy time in that we have only 650 hours to airplane completion point, having terrific struggle with the wing." That long, narrow wing was two-thirds as long as the length of the fuselage, and crucial to sustained high-altitude flight. But wings that long created structural problems, including a bending instability in flight known as aeroelastic divergence, a fancy way of describing wings flapping like a seagull's and possibly tearing off. We worked on the problem around the clock. Kelly, meanwhile, was a blur of activity, juggling 5 or 6 production problems simultaneously. As our airplane neared completion, he was also sweating out the construction of our remote facility. Fronting for the CIA under the phony C&J Engineering logo, he hired a construction company to put in wells, 2 hangars, an airstrip, and a mess hall in the middle of a desert in blistering 130-degree summer heat. At one point, the guy Kelly used as his contractor put out a subcontracting bid. One subcontractor warned him, "Look out for this C&J outfit. We looked them up in Dun & Bradstreet, and they don't even have a credit rating." This base was built for only $800,000. "I'll bet this is one of the best deals the government will ever get," Kelly remarked to several of us. And he was right. By early July, both the airplane and the test site were nearing completion, when Kelly suffered a nearly fatal car wreck after a driver ran a red light in Encino and clobbered him. He was hospitalized with 4 broken ribs, but hobbled back to work in less than 2 weeks, just in time for what he referred to in his log as a terrific final drive to finish the airplane. The first U-2 was completed on July 15, 1955. I remember the sense of shock I experienced the first time I stood next to it on the assembly floor. The airplane was so low slung that although I was slightly less than 6 feet tall, my own nose was higher than the airplane's. Over the next few days, the airplane was subjected to all kinds of flutter and vibration and control tests, culminating in the most severe test of them all, Kelly's personal final check and inspection. "I found 30 items to improve," he told Dick Bohm with a grimace. On July 23rd, the airplane was disassembled and loaded into special shipping containers. At 4 in the morning, the containers were loaded in a remote section of the Burbank Airport onto a C-124 cargo plane and roared off before sunrise, headed for the desert base. Kelly followed in a C-47. We unloaded the bird on schedule into the semi-completed hangars and assembled it. We were ready to fly. Other voices. Tony Levere. In early July, Kelly called me in and told me to get ready to go up to the ranch, as he called the base, and start flight tests. First time I flew there since the day I took Bissell and Kelly up, I almost fainted at the changes. Holy mackerel, they had put in a runway, had a control tower, 2 big hangars, a mess hall, a whole bunch of mobile homes. We had on hand only 4 engineers and 20 maintenance, supply, and administration people. Nowadays, they'd probably use 20 people just to fuel an airplane. The U-2 was very light, very fragile, very flimsy. Kelly wanted to know how I planned on landing it. I had never landed on glider wheels before, in tandem. Usually a pilot likes to make a landing approach nose high, but the landing problem was on Kelly's mind, causing him concern. I got advice from other pilots who said not to land it on the nose wheel. Otherwise, I faced the danger of porpoising, which could lead to a structural breakup. But Kelly contradicted that advice. He said, "No, I want you to land it on the nose wheel. Otherwise, if you come in dragging your tail nose high, I'm afraid you might stall out and lose the airplane totally." Dry lake beds are very tricky to land on at times. Given desert lighting conditions, you can't always tell how low you are. So I had them lift the U-2 off the ground so that the wheels were barely touching, just as if I was first touching down on a landing, and the horizon out there was the horizon I would see as I came in. I sat in the cockpit and took black tape and marked it on the cockpit glass, even with the natural horizon. I did that on both sides. The black tape markers would tell me when I was lined up precisely with the horizon, and that meant my wheels were just touching the ground. On August 2, 1955, I made my first taxi test in the airplane, towed it out on the lake 300 feet. Kelly told me to taxi and throttle up to 50 knots and then hit the brakes. I pushed down on the pedals. God, they were sorry brakes. Kelly got on the horn and said, "Okay, now take it up to 60 knots and hit those brakes." I did as I was told. Then he said, "Now take it up to 70 knots. So that's what I did, and I realized we were suddenly in the goddamn air. The lake bed was so smooth I couldn't feel when the wheels were no longer touching. I almost crapped. Holy Christ, I jammed the goddamn power in. I got into stall buffet and had no idea where the goddamn ground was. I just had to keep the goddamn airplane under control. I kept it straight and level, and I hit the ground hard. Wham! I heard thump, thump, thump. I blew both tires, and the damn brakes burst into flame right below the fuel lines. The fire crew came roaring up with extinguishers, followed by Kelly in a Jeep and boiling mad. God damn it, Levere, what in hell happened? I said, Kelly, the son of a bitch took off, and I didn't even know it. Who'd have guessed an airplane would take off going only 70 knots? That's how light it was. Our first real flight test took place late in the afternoon a few days later on August 4th. I took off around 4 in the afternoon with big black thunderclouds building fast. I took her up to 8,000 feet with Kelly following behind me in a T-33, piloted by my colleague Bob Mate. I got on the horn. Kelly, it flies like a baby buggy. Rain was starting to splatter the windshield, so we decided to cut the first flight short because of the weather. Kelly was getting edgy as I circled around to make my approach for a landing. Remember, I want you to land it on the nose wheel. I said I would. I came down as gently as I knew how and just touched the nose wheel to the ground, and the damned airplane began to porpoise. I immediately pulled up. What's the matter? Kelly radioed. The porpoising effect could break up that airplane. That was the matter. I told him I just touched the damn thing down and it began to porpoise on me. He told me, take it around and come in even lower than last time. I did that exactly, and the damn thing started to porpoise again. I gunned it again. By now, it's really starting to get black, and the rain and wind are kicking up. Kelly is in full panic now. I can hear it in his voice. He's afraid the fragile airplane will come apart in the storm. He yells at me, bring it in on the belly! I say to him, Kelly, I'm not going to do that. I came around the third time, and I held her nose high just like I had wanted to, and put her down in a perfect two-pointer, slick as a cat's ass. Bounced a little, but nice enough. The minute I was down, the sky opened up and it poured, flooding the lake bed under 2 inches of water. That night we had a big party and we all got smashed. Tony, you did a great job today, Kelly said to me. Then he challenged me to an arm wrestle. The guy was strong as two oxen, but what the hell? He banged my arm down so hard he almost busted my wrist. I had it all bandaged up the next day. What in hell happened to you? He asked me. He was so soused, he didn't even remember arm wrestling me. Ben Rich. On that day, British and West German intelligence finished tunneling into East Berlin to eavesdrop on Soviet and East German military headquarters. Alan Dulles visited the Oval Office and made his report personally to President Eisenhower. I've come to tell you about two successes today, one very high and the other very low.
7. Overflying Russia. A month after the first U-2 flight, the Skunkworks test pilots were soaring 70,000 feet above the desert, breaking all existing altitude records in secret. After a few months, our pilots had logged 1,000 hours of flight time, had been to 74,500 feet, and had flown 10-hour, 5,000-mile missions on one tank of gas. Kelly was delighted by the airplane's performance, even though our pilots experienced frequent engine stallouts at these extreme altitudes, forcing Pratt and Whitney's engineers to log huge overtime, adjusting their high-altitude engine to become more efficient. With its enormous wingspan, designed to provide quick lift, the U-2 was able to glide for 250 miles from 70,000 feet, taking more than an hour to do so. Pilots couldn't restart their engine unless they descended to the more oxygen-rich altitude of 35,000 feet or lower. Meanwhile, that damned engine caused another big headache by spraying oil onto the cockpit windshield via the compressor that ran the cockpit air conditioning. That was my domain. The airplane held 64 quarts of oil, and we often had to replace 20 lost quarts after a flight. Our pilots breathed potentially volatile pure oxygen inside their sealed helmets, while their windshield dripped potentially volatile hot oil. I tried all kinds of solutions, but in desperation I heeded a suggestion made by one of our veteran mechanics. Why don't we just stuff Kotex around the oil filter and absorb the mess before it hits the windshield? With great hesitation, I approached the boss. Those steely eyes narrowed and he studied me hard. I saw my brief career at his side evaporate in one explosive bellow. Rich, you're out of here. Kelly silently heard my sanitary napkin suggestion, then raised his eyebrows, shrugged, and said, "What the hell? Give it a shot." I called the crew out at the facility and told them to stand by for a delivery of industrial-sized cartons of sanitary napkins being airlifted their way immediately. And by God, it worked. But then a mysterious problem suddenly developed that held potentially disastrous consequences. The ground crews began reporting broken rubber seals inside engine valves and leaking pressure seals around the cockpit. The rubber had badly oxidized in only a few weeks, leaving all of us scratching our heads. We replaced the seals, but a few weeks later the seals leaked again. As it turned out, the answer to the mysterious malady was revealed one day on the front page of the Los Angeles Times, just beneath the fold. The article reported how European-made automobile tires were proving to be totally unacceptable for Los Angeles motorists. Because of our smog, the article reported, the rubber was badly oxidizing and causing tire fatigue, leading to flats and rapid deterioration. The villain was ozone, a key component of our noxious smog. U.S. tire manufacturers, aware of the smog problem, added silicone to the rubber for their tires shipped to Southern California in order to avoid this oxidation problem. Reading that story, I almost jumped out of my chair. The U-2 was flying at the top of the troposphere, which was heavily laden with ozone. I mentioned the article to Dick Bohm, the U-2 program manager, who took it directly to Kelly. The fix was made quickly. All our seals were replaced with silicone, and the problem vanished. Despite the dreadful hours and the problems they caused in family life, the Skunk Works was, for me, far more splendid than a misery. Each day I found myself stretching on tiptoes to keep pace with my colleagues. Working with that crew was invigorating and fun. One of my favorites was our hydraulics guru, Dave Robertson, who in his spare time built toy square shells for a toy square cannon he invented, just to prove it could work. One Sunday I went over to his house and we lit the powder charge on the front lawn. Boom! The square projectile shot in a high arc across the street and blasted through the neighbor's upstairs window. "Wow," Dave grinned. "That little sucker really works." I turned to Dave for help and advice during that period of U-2 test flights in the summer of 1955, when our test pilots began reporting duct rumble at 50,000 feet, describing the sensation as driving down a deeply rutted road on four uneven tires. In an airplane as fragile as the U-2, such severe shaking was a serious problem. The cause was flying at a slant, so that more air was entering one of the twin air intake ducts than the other. The problem landed directly in my lap, since I had designed the intakes. Dave helped me design a splitter to enhance more even airflow, and that helped to alleviate the problem, but not entirely. At 50,000 feet, pilots were continuing to experience a roughness, although not to the point of watching their wing flaps so that they broke into a cold sweat. I told Kelly, "We've got it under control, but it won't go away." I have no idea why it happens only at 50,000 feet. He didn't either. He just told our pilots, "Avoid flying at 50,000 whenever possible. You should be up higher than that anyway." Pratt and Whitney finally solved the problem completely a year or so later by revising the fuel control for a better match of air and fuel into the engine. But our test pilots had a lot more on their minds than rumbling ducts. Landing the U-2 on its two tandem wheels was neither easy nor routine. Our veteran test pilots warned Kelly that training CIA pilots to fly the U-2 and not getting one or more killed in the process was going to be a major challenge. Pilots were also apprehensive when hitting clear air turbulence and watching those long, thin wings flapping like a bird's, worrying that the next big gust would snap them off entirely. And by the way, there were no ejection seats in the early models of the airplane. Ejection seats would add 30 pounds above a regular seat. So to save precious weight, the CIA decided to dispense with them altogether. U-2 pilots would be trained to fly 9-hour and 40-minute missions, flying round-trip on deep penetration flights over the Soviet Union. The pilot needed an iron butt for 10-hour flights. "I ran out of ass before I ran out of gas," some U-2 drivers would later complain. And who could blame them? A pilot was jammed inside a cockpit smaller than the front seat of a VW Beetle, laced into a bulky partial pressure suit, his head encased in a heavy helmet, hooked to an oxygen-breathing tube, a urine tube, and fighting off muscle cramps, hunger, sleepiness, and fatigue. If the cabin pressure and oxygen supply cut off, a pilot's blood would boil off in seconds at more than 13 miles above sea level. The U-2 was a stern taskmaster, unforgiving of pilot error or lack of concentration. No U-2 pilot, no matter how tired, would risk a few winks and leave the driving to his autopilot. The airplane demanded extraordinary pilot vigilance from the moment of takeoff. It was designed for an immediate, steep climb, but it was critical to keep the wings level because they stored a very heavy fuel load, and as the U-2 rose in the sky, the fuel expanded under diminishing air pressure. One wing would sometimes feed the fuel into the engine more quickly than the other, and that upset the airplane's delicate balances. To regain this balance, the pilot had to activate pumps that moved fuel from one wing to the other. Another very tricky aspect of flying this particular machine was maintaining carefully controlled airspeed. A pilot could fly up to 220 knots during a climb with a special gust control turned on that stiffened the wings and allowed it to hit wind gusts of up to 50 knots. But he also had to guard against climbing too slowly, that is, below 98 knots. Or the airplane would stall and fall out of the sky. Above 102 knots, the airplane experienced dangerous Mach or speed buffeting. So the slowest it could safely go was right next to the fastest it could go as it climbed steeply to above 65,000 feet. And the shuddering felt the same whether it was the result of going too fast or too slow. So a pilot had to keep totally alert while making corrections. A mistake might make the buffeting worse and shake the airplane to pieces. And to make life more interesting, our test pilots reported that sometimes during a turn, the inside wing would be shaking in stall buffet, while the outside wing was shaking even more violently in Mach buffet. Once the pilot reached 70,000 feet, he tried to maintain 400 knots true airspeed, about as fast as a commercial jetliner, and keep the engine from overheating and operating at maximum efficiency. At altitude, the pilot flew nose high and wings level, so for him to be able to see down, we installed a cockpit device known as a drift sight, basically an upside-down periscope that had four levels of magnification and could be swiveled in a 360-degree arc. The pilots also had to plot their navigation by sextant, plotting precise routes while maintaining total radio silence, and photographing particular targets with the pinpoint accuracy of a bombardier. A screw-up could mean death by ground fire or fighter attack, and a guaranteed international crisis. The airplane and the missions were much too demanding to trust to any but the best pilots available. The CIA found that out in the late fall of 1955 when they made a totally off-the-wall decision to try to recruit foreign pilots to fly this top-secret program. The rationale was that it would be less embarrassing if, say, a Turkish national was shot down over Russia than an American. Our government could plausibly deny any involvement. The president had cut out the Air Force from the U-2 program on the basis that the CIA was better at keeping secret a very classified program, and that if a plane should be shot down, it was not as provocative somehow with a civilian pilot at the controls as with an Air Force fighter pilot. Much to the chagrin of the Air Force and of several high-level CIA officials, the White House ordered the CIA to recruit pilots from NATO countries who could pass themselves off as pilots for an international high-altitude weather survey program, which was the cover story for the U-2 operation. So seven foreign pilots arrived in the late fall of 1955 and began training under the tutelage of Colonel Bill Yancey of the Strategic Air Command,
and a small crew of top-notch blue-suiter flight instructors who had been thoroughly checked out on the U-2 by our own test pilot corps. But from the first day, the undertaking appeared hopeless. The pilots lacked experience to fly such a demanding airplane as the U-2, and several of them freaked out, realizing that they would be forced to land on two tandem wheels. In less than 2 weeks, they were sent packing, and Kelly noted with a sigh of relief in his journal, "It's been decided to use only American pilots from now on. Thank God." Before the year ended, General Curtis LeMay, the tough cigar-chomping commander of the Strategic Air Command, got into the U-2 Act by insisting that SAC recruit the pilots for the U-2 program. LeMay was furious that his own organization was not running the program operationally and thought that Eisenhower had lost his senses by allowing the CIA to start up its own Air Force. He raised so much hell with Air Force Secretary Harold Talbot that he was finally cut into the deal around the edges by being tasked to hire and train the pilots from within SAC, with the additional promise that U-2s would be made available to the Blue Suiters at some future time. In those days, the Strategic Air Command had its own fighter wings that were used to escort its bomber force into combat. The SAC fighter pilots selected would have to resign their Air Force commissions and come to work for Lockheed as contract employees under assumed names. We would put them on our payroll and so integrate them into the company that, at the end of the line, even the KGB might have a tough time tracing any of those pilots back to the military. The spooks called this kind of total identity change sheep-dipping. This was about as close as the government and private enterprise were likely to get as teammates in top-secret espionage. The Skunk Works would also be reimbursed by special government funds for the salaries and use of its mechanics and maintenance people who would service the U-2s at the secret overseas bases for the duration of the overflights. The agency insisted on using our mechanics over the usual Air Force crews, simply because we held the monopoly on knowledge and experience on the workings of the U-2, and on these critical missions over Russia, there was no margin for any mechanical failure. We needed perfectly functioning airplanes from takeoff to landing. No pancake landings on a Russian beet field, thank you. God knows the Skunk Works had gone out of its way to earn the agency's trust. We had even kept the production line going by putting up our own money when Congress was late appropriating money to the CIA's Secret Contingency Reserve Fund. Eventually, more than $54 million was allocated for the U-2 program. Out of pure patriotism, Kelly defied one of his own strictly held commandments, number 11 to be exact, which insisted that a customer's funding must be timely. We were sticklers for delivering prompt monthly progress reports to customers and keeping a close accounting of our costs. Kelly required incremental customer payouts to keep us from having to carry the government with our own bank loans. But because of the national security urgency, Kelly obtained a $3 million bank loan to cover our U-2 production costs, at a time when interest rates were only about 5%. Still, it was a good example of a defense contractor bailing out his government. And at the end of the line, we were actually able to refund about 15% of the total U-2 production cost back to the CIA, and in the bargain, build 5 extra airplanes from spare fuselages and parts we didn't need because both the Skunk Works and the U-2 had functioned so beautifully. This was probably the only instance of a cost underrun in the history of the military-industrial complex. The first group of 6 U-2 pilots recruited from the SAC fighter squadrons showed up at the Skunk Works in the fall of 1955 wearing civilian clothes and carrying phony IDs. They spent 3 days getting a thorough briefing on the airplane before flying off to the secret base to begin training with our test pilots. I remember talking to one of them, a nice dark-haired fellow with a soft West Virginia accent who asked me a few technical questions about the air intakes. I would instantly recognize him 4 years later when his face was plastered on the front page of every newspaper in the world as Francis Gary Powers. I learned that those pilots were being paid $40,000 annually with an additional $1,000 a month bonus once they became active overseas. The $40,000 would be held for them by our payroll department, and they'd collect it only after they were mustered out, which meant they had to survive in order to collect their just rewards.
Those pilots disappeared off my screen on the morning when they flew off to the base in a CIA-operated C-47 that had all its passenger windows blacked out. But since Skunkworks mechanics and ground crews were used exclusively to maintain the airplanes overseas, and several of my colleagues were forced to make periodic quick trips to add some new device or make a fix, we were able to keep up with the U-2 operations in fits and starts. The first contingent became operational, setting up at a base in Wiesbaden, West Germany, only 10 months after the first test flight, and less than 18 months since